sometimes in October, I think it's the second half of October, if I remember right, they announced that Lodz will be annexed to the German Reich, which I don't know whether you came across the Warta line, was up to the Warta, one side of the Warta line was annexed to the German Reich and the other was the Protectorate, but we were on the German side. So from 300,000 Jews, by the end of the year, by the end of 1939, it came down to about 160,000. We all expected that if it is under the German Reich, we have no chance. But where it is outside the Reich, we may have a chance. So people left. Our family, we did the same. We left to the Izbice there, where to see well, maybe there will be better. It's a small place, it's a province, perhaps it will be easier for food. So we looked where it was safer and maybe a bit extra food. We come there, we find out it's also under the Reich. And the harassment was even worse than in the bigger city, because everybody, because they had immediately, they had the help and the cooperation from the Poles. Wherever, everywhere. And they knew, in a smaller place, the Poles knew exactly where every Jew lives. Where in a bigger city, it wasn't quite as bad. After a few days, we said, we better make our way back. And then, way back, so how do we get back? A Jew is not allowed to travel on a train. It's 130 kilometers. But we had no option. And by that time, I would say we were all already. We felt that we lost. We finished. It's all gone. It's all lost. So we got on a train from there to Kowal. From Kowal, we changed the train to Lodz. And as we died from, not so much from Kowal, but from this small place, this village to Kowal, and Poles were looking at us, they recognized us. And in the, until a certain part, after travel maybe an hour, then they said, "You lucky Jews." I says, "Why are we lucky Jews?" Oh, it says they travel this route every day because they smuggled the potatoes for sugar. This is how even the Poles managed to exist, by going and smuggling food from one place to another and exchanging and so on. And this is that we travel here every day. And in this particular part, the Germans walk right along the train, and if they spot any Jews, but they didn't. The German, a Pole always recognized a Jew because we lived with him, brought up with him. It was surprised how many thousands spoke a reasonable good Yiddish. They learned from the neighbors. But a German couldn't recognize you. That's one thing. They didn't know, he's a Jew. The Germans know. So obviously they pointed out to the Germans, Jude. So opened the window and threw the Jude out while the train was going. And just in that time, that day, there was no German guard on the train. So is that luck, or is it a coincidence? I don't call it luck. If it is luck, I mean, the Jews who were thrown out of the window the day before, they were no better than I was. They know was no better. And we made our way eventually back to Lodz. Fortunately, this was a miracle. All our furniture, whatever belongings we had, there was left. Now that was a miracle. And by that time, we were about 170,000 Jews from the 300,000. In January, 1940, posters went up right across the greater city of Lodz. in German and in Polish, both languages, that a ghetto in the, well, the plan of the city of the youth park, a ghetto will be formed, and they had a plan which was 1.5 square miles in the northern part of the city. Sewage was poor, very, very, the accommodation terrible, very poor. Actually, they wouldn't put us in any in any posh places. So they picked the worst part. And all Poles should move out, should leave that part, and no Jews from the whole greater city of Lodz should move in. And fortunately, that was fortunate, where we lived, the Franciszkańska, this was the Franciszkańska, in about, no more than from where the house was, 10 meters from us, was a Smogowa, and that was the border. From there, it went down to the northern part. So, it was wonderful, at least we keep our own room, our own home. Because once the Poles got out, they were the first to chase out, they really chased them out, to make room for the Jews to get in. And then they allocated. I mean, people, you can see, I mean, they pushed, they said, we can take with us whatever we can carry. So people in prams, little trolleys, they put in, and you can see people of very high stature, very, people who really knew how to live and everything, you know, these poor people, all in the, where our street was, that was the opening, and they went past this Franciszkańska there, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, and the faces down, it was a tragic sight to see, a tragic sight. And they allocated them, a family, 5, 6, 7, 8, or even 10, they had so many square meters, probably a room no more than half of this room. By beginning of March, because they said on the 30th of April, that is the last day to move in, because the following day, May 1st, the ghetto would be formed. And then right away, they took the Jews from all over, captured them, they rounded up Jews, and we worked, I did as well, for weeks and weeks, and made a fence right round. It was a plank of wood, barbed wire, plank of wood, barbed wire, and every 50 meters, a watchtower. The whole place, right around. In a way, we felt like, well, maybe it would be better, we won't be faced by them, we'll be better. Because what we didn't expect it, how they're going to feed us and what they're going to do with us there. What conditions they will leave us in. We didn't realize. So by March, sometimes in March, they were not happy at all. The Jews from the greater part, from the modern part, I mean, Lodz was no different than any other city. You had a poor part and a richer part, which all cities have. From the richer part, the Jews didn't live quick enough. They didn't leave quick enough for the ghetto. So what did they do one day? Sort of they staged like a pogrom in the main part where really the elite lived there. They attacked them during the day, during the night, and shot virtually thousands, took them and shot them, people were never seen again. And they said, right, now start moving into the ghetto quick. But from that time, they were not allowed to take anything with them at all, as a punishment. And this went down, it happened, went down until the end of October, the end of April. As a farewell, before they closed the ghetto, what did they do? April 20, me again being nosy, I went there. April 20, Hitler's birthday.
Is this 1940?
1940, yes. April 20, Hitler's birthday, said he gave us a farewell present. There was a place on the Lutomierska Street where all the coaches from all over Poland came in, at Victoria Station in London, a massive place. And they erected a gallows, and they hung 23 men. Why 23? That's how they felt. To celebrate Hitler's birthday and a farewell to us.
Did you see the photo?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I've seen them hanging there, young men. And, you know, it's tragic. There's somebody just around the corner here, Abram Pavlovsky. Only about a year ago, it was a little park here, and Saturday afternoon I walked out there in a meeting there, we talked. I didn't even know that he came from Lodz. And I just happened to tell him. When we talked about it, where he lived, he says, oh, he lived in Lodz. I said, where did you live? Lodz. And he told me where, on the Lutomierska Street. Oh, I said to him, the last time I was in Lutomierska Street was April 20, 1940, when I saw 23 men hanging. So he said, he started laughing. I said, what's the joke, Abba? He says, they live next door, where they live next door to this place. He says, he was a youngster, 7 years of age. And he heard men hanging there, so he says, I went there. What did I know? I was a kid. So he went into the back to his mother, and he says, oh, mother, what I've seen, just go out and see, and there's 23 men hanging. And the mother started crying, and he still didn't know what it was. He was a child. It was something funny, something great, what he's seen. And I would say he's the youngest from us. But the truth was, he will not talk to anyone about it. He just cannot, and he won't. Nice boy, very nice, very respectable. So he went home, told the mother. To him, a bit of fun. So, anyway, May 1st, they get a complete cut-off. No soldier, nothing. Fine, all right. Now, I've got to go back now, how they had to start the administration to administer the ghetto. About 2 weeks after they occupied the city of Lodz, so they went into the community building. You can imagine, I mean, the building, the administration of which we had all institutions, old homes. We had the Helen Novick, which was the largest Jewish orphanage in the world, was in Lodz, Helen Novick. And to administer all this, and the poor people had to be handed out food and some money twice a year for Passover and for the New Year. And it was a big administration with a very big building. So they went in there, and there was an old man there by the name Rumkowski, nearly 70 years of age, and three or four younger men. So the Gestapo comes in to this building and says, now this Rumkowski was a Lithuanian Jew, so again he couldn't speak German. And they said, they screamed out, where is the älteste der Juden? Ältest in Yiddish and in German as well, which it can be, oldest. Ältester is the leader. He didn't understand what it, he didn't know what it meant. He took it for granted who's the oldest. He put his hands up. Fine. What is your name? Rumkowski. Fine. Are you a member of the council? He said, yes. Who do you represent? Oh, he says, he represents Helen Novick, the orphanage. He's the father of the orphanage, and he's on the council. The usual to get, make sure he gets the regular money and to keep them their expenses and so on. Fine. He didn't know what hit him, he didn't know. From now on, we give you, that was only about 2 or 3 weeks after they entered, we give you instructions and you carry them out. They already prepared an administration. Of course, when the ghetto was closed in, Rumkowski was the leader. The German administrator who handed out the orders to Rumkowski was Hans Biboff, a civilian German. Rumors went around that he was a relative of Hitler. There were rumors, but could be true, could be not. Very young, handsome fella. Biboff gave Rumkowski the instructions. Biboff received the instructions for the ghetto from Himmler. Only Himmler told him what to do, because Himmler was the head of the Gestapo, right? And Himmler was the next to Hitler. That's how it was. It was Hitler, Himmler, Biboff. The only German office they established in the ghetto, in the center of the ghetto, was the Kripo, Kriminalpolizei, which stands for Kriminalpolizei. They were there to try and get out from as much as they can from the booths. After all, everybody still had a bit of gold, furs or whatever, or good furniture. And they simply went around and tried to search, and they found plenty. They bring people in, like, you were rich, give me the gold. And they torched in there. Anybody came out from there, either dead or not normal. The Kripo, that was, it was the Pavlik of Warsaw. That was the Kripo was. So, Rumkowski, they told him, these people said, mad, set up a whole administration, a police, even a court. If a Jew does anything wrong, bring him to court. And a Jewish judge will punish, will give him a sentence. A post office, schools for children, hospital. And we felt, well, this is going to be fine. In fact, it was like a state within a state. And this went on for about a year, year and a half. Again, to get us climatized and to accept everything. Then they started setting up industries, which eventually every kind of industry, from making furniture for the Germans, for the biggest industry was uniforms. Between 20 and 30,000 people worked in tailoring factories making uniforms for the German soldiers. But the biggest problem was to set up a register and issue rations. And that took time. And they started sending in potatoes and turnips. That's only vegetable turnip. And it was opposite us was like a big, before the war, a big place where they had wood, sold wood, and a wooden mill it was. So they took these places, there was fenced around and put potatoes and whatever went with it there. By the end of May, it started to smell like anything. We got hungry. So what do we do? And there were several right across together, wherever the store like this was, tore it open and try and bring some food home. Because rations were not distributed. So I went there. Most of it was rotten already. But still, rotten or not, it was food. We brought it in. We didn't throw it out. Even it was rotten. And the Germans found out. So what do we do? They came in an open car with Rumkowski in the middle in the car, and they stopped with the machine guns. Fortunately, where we lived was across the road, so I ran into our room and I was safe. And hundreds were shot down with the machine guns. Whether Rumkowski volunteered or they took him specially, they probably wanted to demoralize him as well. So now look, you better do what we tell you, or you see what is going to happen to you. Somehow, he became younger looking, if anything. He's a man of 70. He went round on a droshka. I don't know whether you've heard of the name droshka. It was a coach with a horse that was closed in the winter with his hat, high boots, with his a coat with a fur lining. Yes. And many times he came and he had his face was blue from banging, which we were told people who worked in the near him there said that he didn't do quite quick enough what Bibov told him. So he punched him in his face. The rations were sorted out. And then they started getting what was the rations. I mean, it started off, say, a round bread of maybe 1.5 kilo for 7 days per person. Then it went down for six, then for five, then for four. Always went down and down. A few grams of oil, a few grams of sugar which was brown, it was wet, like paste. And then it was all ersatz, artificial milk, artificial egg, coffee, roasted grain with a straw. And that was our coffee. But we improvised. We made food from the potato peeling with this coffee. Our mothers became experts. Made up meals which you never even dreamt of. But it's in circumstances like these, you grow up overnight. You became an expert in everything. So it was carried on right through 1940. Even for 1940, for our new year, they even allowed us to make from little cinemas to have little cinemas turn into synagogues. Anything. The orphanage was moved from Helenovic into the ghetto, and they gave them a little plot. They grew their own vegetables, the children. And by 1941, no more schools, no more synagogues, disease set in, starvation. People became looking like skeletons, and then, which the worst started from 1941, the knocks at the door. When you went in from work, you went into your room, in winter, dark, cold, miserable, no conversation between the family, nothing at all. Went into the, then listened all the time. Are they knocking at our door or not? Knocks are over, taking out men. In fact, in the course of about, say, between 1941 and August 44, they took out between 60 and 70,000 men by the knock at the door. And then tuberculosis set in, dysentery, typhoid. We didn't have a chance to keep ourselves clean in our hot water. Nothing. And that is estimated saying between 60,000 and 70,000 died from hunger, disease, so the working places became short of manpower. No problem. They brought Jews in from Germany, from over Germany. Hanover, Berlin, because I've seen them. They put them in schools and everywhere. From all the provinces, from the Walter line. And And they replaced the labor. In fact, we were kept to work until we die. That was the principle of the whole object. Remember my father's sister who lived near the little village, but this place called Chodesh. I don't know whether he maybe interviewed him, he met him. Roman Halter. Have you met him at all?
I don't think so.
No. Well, he came from that place. You want to see him, Roman Halter. Ben Helfgott will give you his phone number. Yeah. Now, he came from there, and he came in 1941 or 2, when they sent in the mothers and the children who were too young to take out the work. My uncle, there were six sons. My uncle and the four older sons were taken out in 1940. They were taken to Poznan, where they built the Hermann Göring Highway, Poznan, Berlin. And all my relatives from that part, they all died, all perished, working on that motorway, Poznan, Berlin. It was called the Hermann Göring Weg. Yeah. So, so I heard that a transport from Chodesh came, because we had a prison. The Czerniecko Street was the prison in the ghetto. It also served as the assembly place for people to come in and for people to send out from the ghetto. So I said, oh, well, I'll go there. Maybe it's my auntie. Maybe it's her. Maybe she's still alive. I'll go there. And there I met her, seen her near the fence. Poor woman with the two youngest children. And I said to this Jewish administration, I said, look, it's my auntie here. Can I take her home? And they said, well, you can take her home, but they'll make a note where she goes to, the address, but she cannot have ration cards. So what will you do? I said, well, it doesn't matter. I want to take her home. And I did. So we shared a bit of ration to her. All right, we had so little, it was a little bit less. But I was happy to see when my father looked at each other, never said a word to each other, nothing. But then we're just zombies. Maybe 3-4 days after, during the night, I knock at the door. Necha Blumenfeld? Yes. Moshe Blumenfeld? Yes. Ziskin Blumenfeld? Yes. Come on. Took them away. That's it. We found, after the war, I found out, because while in the ghetto, we didn't know anything. All of them would take the chemno. Yeah. Every one of them. Because all my relatives, my mothers, my fathers, all finished the chemno. So, again, we carried on just like nothing happened. We go to work. Right? My father worked in a tailor factory making uniforms. I worked in a leather factory where we made harnesses for the horses and also all leather goods for the army, strap